This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today we're going to elaborate a bit historically on what's going on in the Ukraine. Will there be a war? Will there be an agreement? What's going on? What's the latest? And then I want to talk about imperialism in general. What we got here, you know, is a classic case of empire building. I'll explain what I mean by that in Ukraine. All right, so what's the latest in Ukraine since we talked about it a few weeks ago? Well, it looks like the imminent invasion is not so imminent. You know, the U.S. has been crying, well, invasion, and Russia's going to invade Ukraine since early December. And they've been putting stakes in the ground, actual days that it's going to occur. You know, I bet the bookies in Las Vegas are placing bets here. And some people are losing money. Hasn't happened yet. Why not? Well, you know, think of what's going on in Ukraine as analogous to a union contract negotiations. You know, I've done that quite a bit in the past, so, you know, I keep thinking of the negotiations going on in light of that parallel, you might say. Well, you know, one thing I learned from negotiations is that whoever controls the bargaining agenda controls the negotiations. In other words, who sets the terms and conditions and the priorities and the meetings are usually those who have an advantage. And so far, Russia is, in my opinion. Putin's cleverly controlling the agenda. And the U.S. is reacting to that agenda. And that means, as far as negotiations, that Putin's winning, I think. And as long as you're getting concessions from the other side, there's no reason to strike. You know, the threat of a strike is often more productive than the strike itself. Think of the invasion of Ukraine as a strike. And Putin is, quote, threatening to invade. And he's getting concessions, not from the U.S. so much, but from the Western Europeans. You see, there's three negotiations going on here in Ukraine. There's the U.S. with Russia that's on the surface, and that's all you're getting reported from by the U.S. media, by the way, and very biased reporting, I might add, and inaccurate reporting. But then there's negotiations going on between Putin and the Western Europeans themselves, particularly France and Germany. And then the third set of negotiations, which we hear nothing about as well, is the discussions going on between Germany and France and the U.S. Three-way negotiations. Pretty complex. And how each of those turn out affects the other. You know, on the surface in U.S. media, you know, you get this thing reporting about imminent invasion and so forth, and you get the proposal, the quote, transparency proposal that the U.S. sent Putin a couple weeks ago, which said, look, you know, you can come and check out our missile sites if you want in Romania and Poland. But you got to let us check out two of your missile sites. And by the way, before this agreement occurs, you got to pull out of Crimea. What a deal. It wasn't a serious proposal. But it was a proposal. It was something. But it wasn't serious. Right. So that's a negotiation going on here at one level between the U.S. and Russia. On another level, there's the shuttle diplomacy and discussions going on between the Western European leaders and Putin. We don't know what's being said and assurances there and so forth. We don't know. You know, the U.S. has a lot to gain by having Russia invade. I wrote this piece, The 10 Reasons Why the U.S. May Want Russia to Invade Ukraine. That's on my blog, jackrasmus.com. Also appeared at a number of places, other blogs, World Financial Review, L.A. Progressive, ZNet, etc. Looking at this negotiation from a little different perspective, you know, what does the U.S. have to gain? The U.S. wants an invasion, I believe, notwithstanding some of the statements. Now, some of the elites in the U.S. don't want it, but there are other elites that definitely do want it. There's a lot to be gained. I'm not going to repeat those 10 reasons. Go read the article. But a lot of it has to do with the U.S. reasserting its hegemony over NATO, which has been fracturing here, especially under Trump, but ever since. Europeans have a lot to lose by a conflict in Ukraine. Certainly it's going to whack their economy that they're desperately trying to get going, which is not even tepidly recovering like the U.S. And politically, who knows what's going to happen? You know, these things spin out of control. So the Europeans, you know, have a lot to lose. They do a lot of trade with Russia. They are dependent on 40% of the natural gas from Russia. The U.S. wants to stop that dependency, especially on natural gas. The U.S. wants to sell Europe its natural gas, which has got a glut. Of course, it would sell it at higher prices because you've got to transport it across the Atlantic. Europeans say, well, why should we pay more? We can get it cheaper from Russia on a pipeline. So the U.S. wants to stop that Nord Stream 2 pipeline. And there are other reasons here why the U.S. prefers a conflict. But, you know, basically to reassert its hegemony and dominance over NATO. But the Europeans, particularly French and Germans, are questioning that quietly, you know, publicly notwithstanding that. They're publicly just saying, oh, unity, unity. But that's just the face to the public. Behind it, they're not so sure that the U.S. is reliable after Trump, because Trump could come back, or a Trump-like figure of foreign policy could come back. They know that. The U.S. political system is very unstable. It's flip-flopping. They can't count on the U.S. They can't count on, oh, Biden is going to be the future here. So, you know, they're trying to go their own way, figure out a way to go their own way, militarily and so forth. And they don't want to be dragged into a war, economically, even politically maybe, you know, into Ukraine. Their economy is too weak. They're unsure about the Americans. They're dependent increasingly on the Russians economically. I mean, there's nothing really to be gained for them and something to be lost. Whereas for the U.S., there's nothing to lose and a lot to be gained. So the negotiations are going on a second level here between Putin and the Western Europeans to try to come to some deal. And that's holding back the U.S. Yeah. But what it means is that, you know, there's no need for Putin to invade if he's getting concessions, even if they aren't official yet. The Europeans will pressure the U.S. to make concessions. Whether they achieve that or not remains to be seen. And then there's the, you know, the linking negotiations between the Europeans and the U.S. Three-way negotiations going on, very complex, and most of it behind the scenes. And virtually all of it not reported by the U.S. mainstream media for purposes that the role it plays. I mean, even PBS, public television, had Victoria Nuland on TV yesterday, given the hawk version and misrepresentations about what's going on in the Ukraine and the border there. You know who Victoria Nuland was? Victoria Nuland came on PBS as the Undersecretary of State, so it's part of the official elite. But she's part of the war hawk elite. Victoria Nuland was the Undersecretary of State in 2014 under Hillary Clinton, who engineered the coup or played a big role in the ultra-right-wing coup that overthrew and drove out an elected government in Ukraine, a pro-Russian government in Ukraine. And Victoria Nuland bragged publicly. She didn't know that she was being recorded. She bragged after that, you know, in a speech in Europe, that the U.S. spent $5 billion to pull that one off. Financed a lot of the grassroots groups and demonstrators, you know, that were behind that rebellion, you know, and the protests and demonstrations that got very violent. They got violent because a lot of those groups that were financed by the United States were outright fascist organizations. Yeah, outright. Declared themselves fascist, ran around, you know, with Nazi symbols, you know, said nice things about Adolf Hitler. You see, the Western Ukraine has always been a fascist hotbed. During World War II, the Western Ukrainians actually formed a German SS unit and fought with the Germans. A division, Das Reich division, against the Russians in World War II in the Ukraine. It's always been a hotbed of fascism in Western Ukraine. See, Western Ukraine is quite different than Eastern Ukraine. Yeah, Western Ukraine is very agricultural. Eastern Ukraine, lots of minerals, coal, and so forth. So these Victoria Nuland bragged about using these fascist shock troops to pull off those violent demonstrations that overthrew the government in Kyiv. And then these same fascist groups went down to the second largest Ukrainian city, Odessa, and murdered over 100 people in the buildings, the government buildings there. And ever since then, these fascist organizations became deputies. Some of them became deputies in the Ukrainian parliament. And some of them formed paramilitary organizations, the most infamous being the Azov Battalion, A-Z-O-V, Azov Battalion, which was heavily involved in precipitating conflict in the eastern provinces that broke away, you know, Luhansk and Donetsk. Very much involved in that conflict there, and still are. I believe they're out there to provoke something. You know, the U.S. talks about a false flag. Well, question is, whose false flag is coming? Yeah, there will be a false flag. But whose will it be? Will it be the Azov Battalion precipitating something? The fascist battalion? And by the way, the Azov Battalion recruited fascists from all over Europe and the world to join it. Even some fascists from South America and different places in Europe, and some mercenaries from the U.S. Yeah, it's quite an organization. It's a full battalion. Oh, they say it's within the control of the Defense Forces, National Guard of Ukraine, but it operates pretty much independently. Okay, so, you know, Victoria Nuland still pulled that off. By the way, Victoria Nuland, once the coup was pulled off, was appointed by Ukrainian parliament as the economic czar for the country. Yeah, same Victoria Nuland. Ran the economy. Or, the economy, meaning opening the door for Western finance and other interests to pour into Ukraine after 2014, take over and or join, merge, joint production, whatever, of the key industries in the Ukraine. The U.S. is deeply involved now in the economy of the Ukraine and running a lot of these companies. By the way, Victoria Nuland herself comes out of a private equity firm out of Chicago. She was, I think she's president or chair. I forgot the name of this company. Yeah, before she got into the U.S. State Department, before she became czar of the economy in the Ukraine. You know, a lot of this history, and even before this 2014 period, I cover in this article on my blog, jackrasmus.com, you know, giving a historical background and evolution of how the U.S. penetrated the Ukraine. And it's a model, you know, that it used in numerous places once the collapse of the old Soviet Union occurred in 1991. Yeah. So, you know, there's imperialism on the U.S. side here going on for quite some time. If by imperialism you mean one country grabbing, controlling, and exploiting economically the wealth of another country, right? You throw together a bunch of these kinds of grabbing and exploiting country by country examples, and you got an empire, an economic empire. And that's what the U.S. has. It has an economic empire globally. And it runs that empire differently than, say, the old British Empire, old European empires. I'll explain why shortly. But it's an empire nonetheless. And the U.S., stations military bases and troops in almost 100 countries around the world to protect its empire, you see. If one of the countries, tries to break free or tries to realign itself with a competitor to the U.S., then the U.S. Military arm goes into action, using the domestic indigenous military as a cover. And if it can pull it off with the indigenous military, fine. But if it can't, it'll send in the Marines. Yeah. So, you know, it's a military backup to an economic empire. But one of the main characteristics of the U.S. empire that's quite different from the British is that the U.S. does not establish political colonies. You know, the British used to come in and establish a political administration and structure to ensure the extraction of wealth from the particular colony that it created. And the U.S. doesn't do that, you see. The U.S. doesn't go in and create a direct political structure and administration. It uses the indigenous capitalist elites to do that. And it backs them up and bails them out when they get in trouble, when there's a rebellion or revolution. It's indirect, politically indirect, but economically even more efficient in extracting wealth than the British system was. The British system was costly. American system is efficient. In other words, it extracts more wealth because it doesn't have the cost of administration. It lets the domestic elites that they form deep alliances with to control and make sure the wealth gets transferred to the U.S. But the U.S. gives them a big bite of the apple, you see. It gives them a big taste, you know. That's how it keeps these indigenous elites on its side. They're all capitalists, you see, and they help each other out and they share it. The U.S. shares its empire with its local capitalists. That's what's different. And they bear the cost of administration. Oh, the U.S. gives them loans and so forth that they need for the administration. But the U.S. Will bail them out if they get in trouble, like Chile in 73, right? The U.S. directly bailed them out. In that case. Okay. Well, let's talk about imperialism in general, and we'll come back to Ukraine. All right. You know, what is imperialism? Well, as I said already, it's, you know, where one country grabs, controls, exploits, and manages the exploitation of another country's what? their resources, or their markets, and or their direct production and financial system. Well, it's pretty obvious when you got an empire that grabs another country's resources, right? And usually those resources, you know, in classical imperial examples are mining, in other words, metals and essential minerals, right? Or markets, control the markets. In other words, you're not just extracting wealth by stealing their minerals or their agriculture, their foodstuffs, right? That's one way. You're taking that, those resources, and grabbing them cheaper, sometimes for nothing. And then you're reselling them back in your home country, right? Or your elsewhere, your empire. Well, that creates wealth, right? On the part of the country that's the imperial country. Or markets. You know, you can extract wealth by controlling markets, not just stealing resources. Right? In other words, you sell your stuff into that colony at a high price, right? And you arrange it so that you buy goods that were produced from that country at a low price, right? And then you resell them at a higher price, you see? That's how that works, right? Or you might even go deeper into it and engage in direct production exploitation. In other words, set up one of your own companies in the colony, pay people super low wages, right? Get super low materials, cheap materials, right? Company pays no taxes, might even get subsidies from its home company government, right? Virtual no local transport costs and so forth. In other words, produce low cost, take the stuff out and sell it high cost, or sell some of it even, within the colony country itself. So empires control resources, empires control markets, empires control production. They even control the financial system, because in capitalism, it takes a currency, it takes a banking system, and so forth. Well, empires dominate the financial system in their colony country. Think of colonies, though, where you have a political structure locally on top of everything to ensure the smooth extraction of resources, control of markets and production. Now, that's colonialism. America doesn't have colonialism in a political sense. It's got economic colonialism, but it doesn't function the way, the old British did, let's say in India, right? Oh, not just in India. What about in the U.S.? U.S. was a colony in the 1770s and 1780s. It was a colony of Britain. In other words, there was a political administration imposed on the 13 states from Britain. The U.S., the colonies, right, could not use their own currency. The currency was the British pound. There were no banks allowed. You had to go through the Bank of England, you see. No banks. In other words, no independent financial system. Very important for exploitation. If you were to send goods, export goods, produce and export goods, you could only export them to London. You couldn't sell goods. The colonies could not sell goods anywhere, to France or whatever. Of course, they smuggled, and they sometimes did, but it had to go to London. And of course, if you control the financial system and the credits, then you can ensure the price of those American exports to London were very low, kept low. The British controlled the price, what they paid for them. And then when the goods got sent to London, Britain resold them at a higher price to the rest of Europe and elsewhere. So you could only sell to London. And by the way, you could only ship to London on British ships. Another way of exploiting and keeping the cost down. And you were charged increasingly different taxes and fees. You know, the Townsend Acts, the Stamp Acts, all that stuff, right? Well, you know, the American capitalists, particularly in the North and New England, were increasingly pissed off with that arrangement, that imperial arrangement. And they rebelled. It was the merchants that rebelled first. But then the plantation owners in the South said, hey, yeah, you know, we're not getting a good deal either. And they reluctantly then joined the 13 colonies in the War of Independence. Classic case. Replicated by British imperialism, you know, in India and elsewhere around the globe. Yeah. But U.S. imperialism is different. How so? Well, as I've been saying, it has no political administration, political structure. Oh, it's got advisors that sit at the elbow of these local capitalists and advise them. It establishes a close relationship with the military, the indigenous military of these countries in this empire. Yeah, it brings them back to the U.S., trains them. The officer corps are integrated and so forth. That's so if the U.S. has to exercise direct military action to prevent a country from breaking away from the empire, maybe going with an adversary, you know, Russia or China or whatever, then the military goes into action. But it uses the domestic military as much as it can, directs them, advises them. Right. That's going on in the Ukraine since 2014. A lot of the U.S. advisors, military advisors, all over the place in the Ukraine, training the Ukrainians desperately now in recent months. Because a lot of these weapon systems, you know, it takes quite a bit of training to use these advanced weapon systems. And that's what the U.S. Special military advisors are really doing. But, you know, that kind of military advisor relationship exists all over the U.S. empire. Okay, so, you know, I also said that what's different about U.S. imperialism is that the U.S. gives the indigenous capitalist a taste, a nice cut of the pie. All right. They're the numbers runners, you know, to use an analogy. You know, they're the street pimps for the U.S. They do quite well, you know. U.S. makes sure it doesn't, alienate the local capitalist. It works very closely with them and gives them a good share of the pie. That's what's different, you know, from previous empires. They were just, the imperial forces would just strip the hell out of the country and squeeze it until everyone rebelled. You know, you go back in history. We'll get back to the U.S., how it's different in history. And, imperialism is not just capitalism. There's a capitalist form of imperialism, but imperialism has been going on for quite some time, right? The earliest form of imperialism was to use a military, your army, and go in and plunder the hell out of the country, you know, grab whatever gold or metals, jewels that were available, grab whatever food stocks and herds were available, and grab people, slaves, and take them back. You know, wars of invasion and plunder. So imperialism, you know, associated directly, you know, almost totally congruent with war in its earliest forms. But then, you know, they got a little smarter and they figured, well, the imperial countries, let's not leave and have to invade again, you know. Let's leave some of our forces here, create a political structure, and get an annual tribute from these people. Not a one-time grab, you know. Let's keep the flow going of wealth. You know, we'll leave some soldiers in some camps to protect our tax collectors. And we'll make sure that there is no contrary organization growing against us here. We'll put it down, right? This was Rome. Rome was pretty good at that, you know, maintaining a structure for tax collectors and continually extracting, you know, the initially when the conquest, the great wealth was in the slaves, some gold and so forth, but great wealth in the slaves. And they even arranged some production on site, food production mostly, you know. I mean, it was famous, the Egyptian grains, grain fields were critical to the Roman Empire. So were the wheat and other grain fields in North Africa. That was critical. And then, of course, even earlier, Rome had conquered a lot of southern and central Italy, and that was some grain production there, too. The Roman Empire collapsed when it lost its grain surplus that it would then sell for money in order to pay its armies. It lost that, you know, when the Roman Empire split Eastern and Western. Well, there went the Egyptian grain fields. And then it really got in trouble when the early barbarians, Vandals and Visigoths, drove in deeply into the empire and took over North Africa. Then, you know, then it had no wealth, no surplus in order to pay its armies, and its armies fell apart. That was the end. So there's always an economic surplus, wealth extraction at the core and heart of every empire. And when that is disrupted, the empire politically, militarily, its days are numbered. And we see that with British wars to establish colonies in the 17th, 18th, 19th century, right? Same thing, going after resources first, staying, creating a political administration, ensuring the exploitation of markets, you know, paying low price, selling at high price, and even setting up some light industry production, you know, like cotton and textiles in India, right? Sugarcane fields in the Caribbean, right? And then wars are associated with obtaining and creating an empire and maintaining an empire for those that attempt to depart from the empire. In the U.S. case, how did Britain create an empire? Well, it went to war with the Netherlands first. That was fought in the English Channel, by the way, between their great fleets and several great wars in the 17th century there, and the British prevailed over the Dutch fleets. The Dutch had, significant colonies in North America. New York, of course, was called New Amsterdam. And in Virginia and Maryland, you know, they had significant colonies there. And Britain went to war over that with the Netherlands. They came to an agreement after two or three of these naval conflicts, and Netherlands gave Britain its colonies in North America, and Britain allowed the Netherlands to maintain agricultural extraction from its colonies in the East Indies. And that was Indonesia today. Spices and so forth. Yeah, the British said, okay, that's your sphere of interest. Ours is India. You know, India and Burma and places like that, Malaysia, Singapore, you know, we have enough holding on to that. You guys can have the East Indies, but you got to give us New York. And then, of course, the British engaged in a series of wars to push the Native Americans out of the colonies, which they did. King Philip's War, and I think it was Virginia, and then there was the Queen Anne's War, they call it. I'm not sure. In New England, yeah, they just pushed the Native, they wiped them out or pushed them out towards the mountains, the Alleghenies, right? Yeah, that was part of the Wars of Conquest, you might say. And then, of course, there's the French Indian War, 1765, where Britain contended with France for control of North America and ultimately defeated them, pushed them out. So wars of conquest, wars are part of empire building, right? But wars are also about empire maintaining. When recalcitrant elements, countries, attempt to go independent or realign themselves with competitors to the empire. Well, you know, a good example of that was World War I. Classic case of war for colonies, for resources between Germany and Britain. To some extent, France. You know, Germany, Johnny come lately to the colonial divvying up of the world, felt that it didn't have its fair share, and the rest is history. But really, that was a war over colonies, you know. And thus, I mean, why colony? Well, for wealth extraction purposes. Yeah. And then World War II, what was that? World War II is just a continuation of World War I, you see. Nothing was really resolved fundamentally in World War I. They had this armistice, and France and Germany France and England bled Germany with reparations that the U.S. paid for. Yeah, the U.S., made loans to Germany so that Germany can pay reparations to Britain, right? And then Britain used that money to pay back its borrowing from the United States during World War I. So the U.S. got the money back. You see, the money flowed from the U.S. to Germany to London back to the U.S. And that's how they maintained the peace for, you know, a decade after World War I. But then, you know, that broke down, and we had a resumption of World War I called World War II. And World War II is really two wars, you see. One was the European War, 1939 to 41, which Germany won. Very clearly, Germany won the European War. But it made the mistake of morphing a European war that it won, arrogantly thought it was that powerful, into a world war. It attacked Russia, which was quite different than the other countries in France in terms of size and resources and organization. And then, of course, it signs this agreement, Axis Agreement, with two weaker, Italy was certainly a weaker partner there, and it had to bail Italy out by creating a third front in North Africa. Yeah. And then it signs this part of this agreement with Japan. Germany gets absolutely nothing out of Japan. And then Japan attacks the United States, and because Japan and Germany are, you know, in this Axis agreement, Germany declares war on the U.S. in December of 41. Just at a time it thought it had conquered Russia, which it hadn't, you know. Big, big error. Converted World War I and the European war that it won into a world war that it would lose very quickly. It lost very quickly. There's no way Germany could compete in production with Russia, let alone Russia and the United States behind it. You see, its economy in 41 was as large as the British Empire economy. In terms of resources, they were about the same, and they came to a kind of a stasis. Britain could not defeat Germany. Germany could not defeat the British Empire. But they made a real dumb mistake. They ate off in the Nazis. Arrogant. Germans can be very arrogant. I know from personal experience in business. You know, they got the clock cleaned. Well, you know, that was imperial too. You know, why did Hitler move east? Well, he wanted the resources, particularly the food resources from the Ukraine and the oil, the Russian oil and Russian coal and Russian minerals and so forth. That's what he wanted. That was a classical, you know, invasion, imperial invasion. Yeah. Wars start oftentimes, you know, to grab resources, to grab markets, or to defend markets and resources from someone else grabbing, or those markets trying to go independent. Those are all different reasons for war. Sometimes war is provoked because of domestic politics. You know, politicians are weak and so forth. They look for distraction. Sometimes they're ideological. There's lots of reasons why countries go to war. So what do we got in the Ukraine here? What is this case example? Well, you know, it's classic, in part, it's classic case of U.S. businesses penetrating, you know, a very lucrative market in the Ukraine and throughout Eastern Europe. You know, Eastern Europe was quickly absorbed economically into the European Union. You know, economic reasons, you know, the Germans and the French. By the way, you know, they moved a lot of their industries, the Germans and the French, the Western Europeans, into Eastern Europe because the wages were so cheap in the 90s. Now, they moved it forward into Eastern Europe. Well, then the military cover follows it, NATO. NATO, but at the origins are the economic movement into Eastern Europe, and now they keep creeping forward, giving NATO a reason for existence, because it, you know, didn't have one after the Soviet Union collapsed. Got to create a bogeyman, you see. You keep that industrial complex going, keep that war machine going. So it's a classic case, in part, not totally, of capitalist penetration of a new market for new resources, but mostly markets. You know, U.S. does not need the resources of Ukraine, but it's a nice way to extract wealth. And as I said, you know, Victoria Nuland and U.S. finance capital plowed into Ukraine. And by the way, you know, a lot of the sons of the elites get appointed on a lot of these boards in the Ukraine. I'm going to talk about Biden and some of the others, too. Someday it'll be revealed how U.S. political elites, you know, invaded businesses in the Ukraine. and some Europeans do, but the U.S. says that it pulled off that coup, was at the heart of this. Okay. How does the U.S. rule its empire, its economic empire? Let's return to that topic. As I said, to reiterate, no political administration, you know, given the local capitalists a nice cut of the pie, military to military support, which it pulls out in extreme cases of problems, integrates the financial system with these countries. You know, U.S. imperialism has created institutions like the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank and the SWIFT international payment system. That triad of institutions, financial institutions, are key to maintaining the U.S. economic empire. The currency of the empire is the dollar. There's some other currencies are used, but the dollar is dominant, still is. International Monetary Fund, what do? Well, they're funded mostly by the U.S., controlled by the U.S., and its role is to provide bailout money to other countries in the empire that screw up their financial system. They get too greedy, they screw it up, and their currency collapses. And then IMF gives them loans, bails them out. Argentina, good example. Repeatedly. Turkey, you know, Philippines, etc. Bail them out. IMF bails out their currency. The World Bank, what does it do? Oh, the World Bank goes in and leads projects for infrastructure development, you might say. Leads projects. In other words, plays a role, puts up some of the money. Again, most of the money put up by the U.S. And private interests come in right on its tail and provide even more money and, of course, extract interest payments for those loans, for those infrastructure projects. The IMF is the same way. You know, the IMF will bail out these countries, put up some money, but then the private banks put in money too. I mean, look at the fight going on in Argentina for a couple of decades now. It's not between the IMF and Argentina. They agreed, but it's the private investors, the private equity funds and so forth from the U.S. that want more. That's what the fight is with and over. And it's continuing. So, you know, U.S. finance capital comes in on the tail of the World Bank and the IMF all the time, gets the lion's share of debt that it extends to these countries to extract the interest payments. And the international payment system, the SWIFT, that's an acronym, SWIFT, is key in this as well. Because that's how the U.S. elites and the banks, U.S. banks, see who is trading with who, who's buying what from whom, who needs the money, who needs dollars, who's got extra dollars. And it's key to the use of sanctions by the U.S., you see. The SWIFT system identifies who is violating the sanctions. You could not enforce sanctions if you did not have the SWIFT international payment system. That's part of the economic empire, the financial aspect of the U.S. economic empire. IMF, World Bank, SWIFT, dollar, global currency, credit, largely controlled by the U.S. And if a country gets out of line, what does the U.S. do? It cuts them off from dollars. It cuts them off from selling their goods in global markets to raise dollars. It cuts them off from buying with dollars needed goods from other countries, you know, medical supplies, food, and so forth, right? Destroy a country's currency and you destroy its economy. The U.S. came damn close to doing that with Venezuela. It cut Venezuela off from access to dollars. It could not sell its oil. It sanctioned it and could not sell its oil to other countries because 85% of all the trade in global crude oil is done in dollars. So Venezuela couldn't sell. If it can't sell its currency, 95% of its budget was from the sale of oil, well, then how could it go and buy critical medical and food imports? It doesn't have the dollars. And if it tried to sell something else, the U.S. sanctions took on the countries that were trying to buy it. That's why Venezuela could only sell basically to Iran, Russia, China. Yeah. Venezuela is a classic case of financial imperialism. How a recalcitrant, you know, rogue, runaway member of the former U.S. economic empire is dealt with. You cannot align yourself, you know, with our adversaries, be they Russia or China. No, no. If you do, you're going to pay a price. We're going to cut you off. We're going to sanction you. You know, we're going to prevent you from using dollars. And if you can't get dollars, well, then you got to sell your own currency. And if that's all you got, your currency appreciates, rises unsustainably, and crashes. And then we're going to finance some groups saying, oh, look, you know, Maduro, Chavez, you ruined the economy. Therefore, we need a new replacement. And then it becomes political, you see. And you as a political advisors go in and so forth. Contrast what happened in Venezuela to what happened in Chile, and you'll see. You know, the U.S. Engages in a lot of wars. It has. Just look at the history of the U.S. wars. In the last 60 years, at least 16 wars in the last 60 years. Yeah, 5 losses, 8 wins, and 3 draws. What were they? Well, clearly the losses, Bay of Pigs, Cuba, that was a loss. Vietnam was a big loss. Afghanistan was a big loss. Smaller losses when it went into Lebanon in 83, and of course the most recent did not prevail in Syria. 5 losses. What were the wins? Well, the wins were the Cold War with Russia, clearly, right? The Gulf One War in 1991, Iraq in 2003, but smaller, beating up on small guy wars like Panama, right? Sending the U.S. into Panama City there under George Bush the First. Hillary Clinton's war in Libya, right? Beating up on Little Grenada, the island, right? And the war against Al-Qaeda could be said to be a victory of sorts, right? So those were the wins. What about the draws? Well, Korea was clearly a draw. The wars in Central America and Nicaragua and so forth, I would say were a draw because the U.S. initially prevailed, but now the same forces have come back and prevailed in Central America, in Nicaragua and so forth. Somalia, right? Clinton's exercise in Somalia. Right. You know, you could probably put Yugoslavia in there somewhere. That's probably a win for the U.S. and the Europeans, right? The Europeans kind of led that. The U.S. let the Europeans pretty much run that, but played a big role in it as well. You know, Germany recognized Croatia in breaking up Yugoslavia even before Croatia asked for it. Yeah, and Slovenia, too. So, you know, Yugoslavia's war, as that European war, yeah, okay. So, you know, 8 wins and 5 losses and 3 draws. And war almost every year for the last 60 years. That's the U.S. economic empire. And now, They're itching for another one in the Ukraine. See, the U.S. likes to fight wars a proxy, and it doesn't want to confront China or Russia head on because, you know, become a nuclear thing. But it's fine to fight them non-nuclear on a proxy ground somewhere. You know, be that ground Vietnam, or be that ground Yugoslavia, you know, or be that ground, you know, in the Middle East, or now in the Ukraine. It's a enticing, neutral proxy geography. Will we have another war? In Ukraine? I don't think so. I think there's going to be an agreement in Ukraine eventually. Unless the U.S. can find a way to really twist the arms of the Europeans and provoke Russia to invade. They talk about false flags. Now, the U.S. got some false flags up its sleeve, too. Now, so imperialism goes on and on. It morphs, it changes over time. U.S. imperialism, very efficient. But there are signs that the U.S. imperial model is beginning to fracture and break down. And what goes on in Ukraine is going to be critical to that whole evolution of U.S. imperialism. You know, U.S. still controls those three institutions, IMF, World Bank, and the SWIFT system. But digital currencies may undermine the SWIFT system, right? And the Europeans may block against the U.S. increasingly here if the U.S. military adventures continue. So we'll see how it all turns out. But basically, it's another expression of imperial conflict. Long list of those here in the Ukraine, the outcome of which will not be as easy as Iraq or some of these other places have been for U.S. military and U.S. Capitalists. But we shall see. Watch it closely and watch how financial imperialism plays a role in these sanctions if there isn't invasion. It will be a case of financial imperialism against Russia. Okay, that's it for today. Next week, see you then.